wasn't sure if anybody would be interested in this topic. I'm glad to see you are. I'm always interested in giving book recommendations. So I thought I would... I'm not sure what happened here with our show. That's not good. Nobody logged in and tried to bump me off Apple TV, do you? Here we go. Now, so just a couple of opening remarks. This is a complex subject, and obviously this is just a little introduction. But I did want to recommend a couple of books to you on the sort of the history of this issue. This is a pretty good book by a man named Roland Bainton. He's best known for his biography on Martin Luther, Here I Stand. You may have read that. But this is Christian Attitudes Toward War and Peace, a historical survey. This is a nice introduction to this topic. And so if you're looking for something to read, that's a good one. If you'd like to read Augustine on this, this little book, The Political Writings of St. Augustine, is kind of nice. What it does is it takes, on whatever particular topic, on this topic on a just war, it pieces together a number of things that he'd written throughout his work. So like there are sections there from City of God, from some of his letters, and it just kind of puts it in a running account. So it's really a nice little book on that subject. It's not very long. The section's not very long on just war, but that is quite good. We're going to read an excerpt from St. Thomas Aquinas, who really builds upon Augustine's arguments, and so we'll take a look at that in just a few moments. But Bainton, in his book, by the way, that I thought was providential, our lesson this morning. You know, there's this image of this man beating his sword into a plowshare. I didn't plan it that way, but I did think that was interesting that our Old Testament lesson was that lesson from Isaiah. We'll come back and talk about that some more in just a moment. But Bainton talks about three attitudes historically for Christians concerning war. And these three are pacifism, just war, and crusade. These developed, as he says, somewhat chronologically. So in the early church, some would say pacifism was completely the attitude toward war in the early church. I think there's a lot to be said for that. However, I think it's a little more complex. There were soldiers, Christians who were soldiers serving in the military during that early period of time. And so I think it's a little more complex than what some scholars say. And Bainton kind of brings that out as well. But really, if you just look at it chronologically, sort of pre-Constantine, pacifism was, shall we say, the primary view. Then when, of course, Constantine comes to power and there's this closer relationship between church and state, then you have the development of what's called the just war theory. And then later on, largely in response to Islam, you have crusade. You know, there were a number of crusades that were undertaken, both against Islam and later on against some of the heretical sects in the Middle Ages. And so that was used, and of course, we know many of those stories. We're still kind of living with some of the issues coming and stemming from that. But let's think for just a moment about, biblically speaking, where would you go to argue for pacifism from the Scriptures? Okay, blessed are the peacemakers. Very interesting. Good, that's a good one. Augustine actually has an interesting section on that. That's good. What else? Turn the other cheek. That's always the biggie, right? When he slices off Malchus's ear. Good. It's interesting on the flip side of that, that in another place he tells them to go and sell their tunic and buy a sword. What do we do with that one?
I'm not
No. I'm with you.
Being a devil advocate.
What other What are the biblical, any other biblical passages? That's a pretty good survey on pacifism. Now, how about on just war? There may be something to that. Some would want to put that on the crusade side, I think. Romans 13, right? The governing authority doesn't bear the sword in vain. He's God's minister, in fact, as St. Paul calls him there, Romans 13.
Do you think that's more an implication of for individual crime, or do you think that's an implication of war?
Well, we'll explore that. That's an interesting question to ask about the statements in the Sermon on the Mount.
Conquest of the Canaanites.
Okay, I think most would kind of put that more on the crusading model, if you will, crusading mentality. But I think an argument can be made it's just since God's the one who commanded it, right?
Lot's captured.
Okay, yeah, good. Yeah, Genesis, that's a passage that frequently is not even talked about. But remember, there's this war around Sodom, and Lot is caught up, and he's taken off, and Abraham gathers his 318 fighting men and goes out and defeats the kings and brings back the spoils and meets Melchizedek. It blesses him right on the way back. So,
John the Baptist didn't tell the soldiers to stop being soldiers.
Okay, very good. We're going to get to that one. Okay, yeah, from the Old Testament about godly kings and what they're called to do. What about the render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's and unto God the things which are God's? I'll pop some of these up in just a minute. But let's think about, we just talked about chronologically how this kind of develops. Think about beyond the Crusades, sort of getting to the end of the Middle Ages, getting up to the time of the Reformation. One of the arguments that Bainton makes is that these models are adapted at various times and appropriated by Christians depending on the circumstances. Can you think of beyond the Middle Ages, where pacifism becomes a preeminent view for some Christians? The Mennonites, very good. By the way, the Mennonites, after this whole debacle, you know, with they had a group that tried to take over the city of the city of Munster and tried to set up the kingdom of God, and then they were violently defeated, and then they went back to the pacifist model. So yeah, Mennonites would be one. Who else?
Quakers.
That's exactly right. Big, you know, they're big proponents of pacifism for sure. All right, how about let's flip to the other side of the Crusade model. When is that taken up beyond the Middle Ages, beyond the Crusades? Who else kind of takes up that model? Well, I think you're right, actually. Pardon? Yeah. Thinking Christian terms. Bainton makes the argument that many of the Reformed churches on the continent took up this model, sort of a crusading model, and that was adapted by the Puritans in England. Cromwell, you know, they would sing psalms riding into battle against their fellow Christians. It was troubling.
I noted it in writing, but a friend of mine was telling me that during the Reformation period, there was a wing in the Catholic Church that was fighting off Islam during the same time as the Reformation was taking place, or shortly after.
Yeah.
You have Vienna and Lepanto.
Yeah, you got all kind of stuff going on during that time. And I think on the other side, thinking about just war theory, Luther and the Anglicans, the Lutherans and the Anglicans end up basically with the just war theory. In fact, one of our articles, I looked again this morning, it was like, it doesn't make it into the American articles because it's about the Queen. But if, I think it's Article 37, if you look at it in the original 39 articles from the 1662 prayer book and going back, it actually says, it talks about just war. It's not in the American articles. I'm wondering, why did you pull that out? But anyway, that's another story for another day. Well, here's a pop-up. Just so you notice how this repeats, if you will, throughout history, that these things are reappropriated. Here's just a screen of some of the passages, and I think we talked about most of these. The one, they shall beat their swords into plowshares, what we read this morning for for pacifism. I mean, the argument would be, well, Christ is the, you know, Jesus is the Messiah. He's come to establish His kingdom, and now aren't we supposed to beat our swords into plowshares? here, I think we talked about the passage with Malchus here, thinking about just war. Do we cover here? Here's one we didn't talk about. 1 Peter 2: Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him, by God, for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. So that's kind of fitting with Romans 13, if you will, that the government or the state, the proper authority, does bear the sword. And then, of course, in the Old Testament, you have a number of places, particularly the conquest of the Promised Land, which could be used to argue for the crusading model. And so, well, you know, God gave the land to His people and told them to go and conquer, and that's what they did to some extent, one or the other. Well, I think an argument can be made that the dominant view in the history of the church has been the just war view. And this is developed, really fully developed, by St. Augustine. You know, there's that old saying about all philosophy after Plato is a footnote to Plato. And I think, really, to some extent, Western theology, we could say that all of Western theology after Augustine is a footnote to Augustine. We'll see that in just a few moments when we read a little bit of Aquinas. But Augustine himself is really developing some of the classical works. In fact, he interacts some with Cicero. It's interesting that before him, his mentor, St. Ambrose, also argued for something akin to a just war. That's brought out once again by Bainton in his historical work. So, really, the just war doctrine, as we think about it, is concerned with two primary issues. First of all, may Christians engage in war? That's the first big issue, right? And the second issue related to that, if so, if the answer to that is yes, then how may war be conducted in such a way that we don't fall into sin? Okay, so those are the two major overarching ideas to think about when considering just war theory. Now, for sake of convenience, we're going to look at an excerpt from Thomas Aquinas's... I need to borrow somebody. Somebody have one I can look at. If you'll flip over to the second page, where it says, I answer that. Notice the question that he's dealing with. If you're not used to reading the Summa Theologica, there's a whole section of war, and there are four different questions that he deals with in the Summa on this. And I pull out the first one, Article 1, whether it is always sinful to wage war. So that's the question. Is it always sinful to wage war? And then he starts off with objections, three or four typically, in this case four objections. He starts off with those, then he gets into sort of the meat of his argument, and then he comes back at the end and answers the objections that he raised at the beginning. Okay, we're going to skip over the objections. I want you to go right to the meat of the argument right here on this second page. In his answer to just war theory, or is it always sinful to wage war? He says, I answer that in order for a war to be just, three things are necessary. First, the authority of the sovereign by whose command the war is to be waged. For it is not the business of a private individual to declare war, because he can seek for redress of his rights from the tribunal of his superior. Moreover, it is not the business of a private individual to summon together the people, which has to be done in wartime. And as the care of the commonweal is committed to those who are in authority, it is their business to watch over the commonweal of the city, kingdom, or province subject to them. And just as it is lawful for them to have recourses to the sword in defending that common weal against internal disturbances when they punish evildoers, according to the words of the apostle, and here's a quote from Romans 13, "He beareth not the sword in vain, for he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil." So too, it is their business to have recourse to the sword of war in defending the common weal against external enemies. So here's the application. The question you were asking a moment ago is internal, external, and he's saying it extends to external. Hence it is said to those who are in authority, he quotes Psalm 81:4, "Rescue the poor and deliver the needy out of the hand of the sinner." And for this reason, Augustine says, "The natural order conducive to peace among mortals demands that the power to declare and counsel war should be in the hands of those who hold the supreme authority." So notice, first of all, the first prerequisite, if you will, for a quote-unquote just war is that it is called for by the supreme authority. I can't just say, "All right, I got a good group here. Grab your pitchforks. You know, let's go make war on the Methodists or something." You know, we can't do that. No, it has to be the proper authority, and it can't be just waged by any private individual decides I want to go to war. Somebody has messed with me, so we're going to go to war. Augustine says, "Nope, that would fail the test of being a just war." It can't be just for vengeance, on a personal basis, or what have you. Secondly, he says, a just cause is required, namely that those who are attacked should be attacked because they deserve it on account of some fault. Wherefore, Augustine says, a just war is wont to be described as one that avenges wrongs when a nation or state has to be punished for refusing to make amends for the wrongs inflicted by its subjects or to restore what it has seized unjustly. So notice, second requirement for a just war is a just cause. And notice how it's basically stated in a sense of primarily of defense. Defending the country, whatever, from an aggressor. He does allow for some wrongs inflicted by its subjects, and we'll come back to that perhaps in just a moment. So notice a second there is a just cause. Thirdly, it is necessary that the belligerents should have a rightful intention so that they intend the advancement of good or the avoidance of evil. Hence, Augustine says, true religion looks upon as peaceful those wars that are waged not for motives of aggrandizement or cruelty, but with the object of securing peace, of punishing evildoers, and of uplifting the good. For it may happen. So notice that this is the third criteria, if you will, is that it has to be a right, the war has to be waged with a right intention. It's not for vengeance, anything bloodthirst, or anything like that. And then he adds, sort of at the end here, for it may happen that the war is declared by the legitimate authority, there's number one, and for a just cause, there's number two, and yet be rendered unlawful through a wicked intention. Hence Augustine says, the passion for inflicting harm, the cruel thirst for vengeance, an unpacific and relentless spirit, the fever of revolt, the lust of power, and such like things, all these are rightly condemned in war. Okay, so notice the right intention, as we'll come back to this in just a moment, is to reestablish peace. That's the right intention for actually going to war. So, here, if you will, summarize for us the three requirements, the three primary requirements concerning a just war. First is a proper authority, second, a just cause, and third, a right intention. Okay? So those are the three primary requirements in order to have a just war. Now, he kind of builds upon this, St. Augustine does. He builds upon this with some other principles, these other truths that I have here for you. And here we go. War should only be waged as a last resort. After every effort has been made, really, to establish peace. It's not as if this is the first thing we ought to do, because really war is not a good thing. We all know this, that war is not a good thing. And so every effort to make things right ahead of time ought to be done. And I think that's just a good practice to try to make peace without going to war. Yes?
Going back to that first point, the proper... Flip back one more.
The proper authority?
Yeah, in terms of the American war, the rebellion in the United Kingdom, who would be the proper authority in the American side?
It's a conundrum. It really is. And this just war, I mean, if you just followed... I think if you followed Augustine's arguments here, if you stuck with that without changing what he says, I think you're on shaky ground.
So who would have been the proper one to declare?
Well, this is if you go back and look at it, they actually talk about this. And what happens is this is developed, if you will, to say if a higher authority, in this case a monarch, is oppressive toward their subjects, then a lesser authority under the higher authority can lead the people in rebellion. Right, exactly. I mean, that's the argument that's made. Now, I think following Augustine...
This is making then is that the only person that can declare the colonies being independent would be the throne of England?
Right.
Because they're the only proper authority?
I think that's where, if you stick with what Augustine says, then I think, yes,
but
that would be correct.
More, I mean, as the highest authority of the Greek party.
Well, it was, yes. Yes, that's what happened.
Charles, would people who justify the American war, would they be sort of moving along the lines of Calvin and Knox? And would that be a departure from St. Augustine?
Bart?
Yeah, I mean, they actually called it the Presbyterian Revolt of America because it was so influenced by Reformed political theology, which had the lesser magistrates who were functionally the House of Burgesses or whatever your houses were for each individual colony, sending representatives to Continental Congress. Bishop Seabury, of course, said, you know, who made you guys the ones to alter the Constitution, if you will, that alters the relationship between us and England? Burke, who sympathized with the Americans, who was in the House and in the Parliament, also said, what we should do if we're good governors in England is we should take the prerogative as the rightful authority and change up the relationship, the constitution, if you will, between the colonies and England to give them the representation they wanted. But dragon's feet and we have to change it.
Well, and it's a replay to some extent of the English Civil War, right? I mean, if you think about it, it's not a real.
On a simple analogy, Father Charles, I think the argument went: if you've got a family and the father is insane, you need to put a straitjacket on it.
Yeah.
If you don't do that, you're culpable.
Yep, I've read some of these analogies. So, yeah.
What about the examples in Scripture where you've got? Jeroboam, where you've got a revolt, and yet God promises blessing to Jeroboam, and he walks in his ways. Of course, he didn't.
Yeah.
Or the situation where Athaliah is queen and kills the royal household, except for Joash. Jehoiada hides him and then brings him in to supplant
Zechariah. Yeah.
There you've got lesser authorities in some capacity stepping in to rectify a situation.
Yeah, I mean, these are some of the arguments that are brought in. But I'm saying, according to Augustine, I think you're taking it a step beyond to do that, and they did. I mean, there's no question that historically, that's what they ended up doing. The American colonies, they took it a step further in doing that. But
I think America should give America.
now that they've come out of Babylon, the European Union. Yeah. With that accent, I'd watch out with the shibboleths and sibboleths.
What you're saying is, if they followed this model, we would still have that 30% part.
Well, it makes you wonder, right? Yeah, we would have. It wouldn't have been an issue. Been praying for the king, queen. Yeah. It's, I mean, all these issues, of course, are complex. And there are a lot of things that are mixed up with in these motivations. And of course, this is not to say that Augustine has the last word on what Christians believe on every matter. However, I think that we certainly ought to listen to this. I mean, it's adapted. The Just War is adapted at the time of the Crusades. It kind of morphs a little bit, and so they're picking up on some of those things. I mean, the American Revolution is not the first time where this is taken up and tweaked a little bit. And like I say,
this argument can be used to go after ISIS and the American government. The argument.
It's been, well, like I say, these things have been developed. If you look further in history, it's been adapted and so forth.
Right.
Question?
For that, is the U.S. president the supreme authority over Syria and Iraq? That's not really the way it exists in today's world.
I think if I understand Augustine, the argument is not to whom would you go to war against, but who is the proper authority
to call for the war, right? To redress offenses.
In light of American history recently, I would say the supreme authority that's worked better in that area of the world is the UN. If you compare the Gulf War to the Iraq War, the results were far superior when the UN was the active force.
I'm just thinking of Augustine's argument that if you're in the American government, whether you're the president or the Congress, in terms of legitimate authority in the state, in the United States, can the proper authority, according to Augustine,
well, these are all things that you need to think through. Once again, they have to be applied to circumstances. I mean, look, ISIS, we're dealing with the people who are all over the place. It's not like they're just in one place, and it's not like they're all united in this. And so, really, some of these things have to be thought through.
You should declare war on ISIS. I'm simply saying, if you're pro declaring war on ISIS, Augustine's your friend. Yeah. You can use Augustine as your friend.
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. I think for sure. And, so let's move on to this. We talked about how every effort should be made to secure peace. Next, the ultimate object of war is always peace. Here's a quote from Augustine. He writes, "Peace should be the object of your desire. War should only be waged as a necessity, and waged only that God may by it deliver men from the necessity and preserve them in peace. Therefore, even in waging war, cherish the spirit of a peacemaker." Here's your passage. He goes on to actually quote that. "Blessed are the peacemakers." You wouldn't think about this in the context of actually going to war to make peace, but that's how Augustine applies it. "Cherish the spirit of a peacemaker, that by conquering those whom you attack, you may lead them back to the advantages of peace." An argument can be made, I think, from some of the things that Augustine says, that in vanquishing your foes, those who are evil, to vanquish them, in some sense, is actually doing them a favor. Because it's stopping them from doing evil things that will result in a greater judgment for them. So, just... there's one for you to think on and chew on. Yeah, and I'm going to shoot you for your own good. I'm going to stop you from. But I mean, think about this in terms of a suicide bomber. If you stop someone, and of course this is all very touchy as we're living with, but if you have someone who's going to blow up 300 people, and you shoot him and stop him from going and blowing up the 300 people he desired to blow up, then perhaps his judgment, in sort of applying this, his judgment will be less because he wasn't actually able to carry out what he wanted to do. Now, of course, all this rests upon the idea that we actually believe in God's justice and in the punishment for those who do evil. which today is not exactly a given. But historically, Augustine had a very strong sense of God's justice, of making things right. So in that case, shooting that guy and stopping him from going and blow up 300 people actually ends up being a favor in a sense to him. Not that he's not going to judgment, but that the judgment that he incurs will be less than what it had been had he killed 300 people. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Because Christ said that if you think in your heart, you've done it.
Well, this is one of the arguments that is raised, I used to teach this in my church history classes. The class would typically revolt at this idea because of this. But I think that God's judgment upon us rests upon what we actually, not only upon what we intend or perhaps think about, but really upon what we do. I think an argument could be made. Right, I think the argument could be made that the latter is worse than the former. You know, to think about killing someone is bad, and of course, sin and worthy of judgment.
Let's say that I'm really mad at you, and so I'm pondering murdering in my heart. Well, then I've got that sin.
Right.
But I don't act on it. Then I haven't acted on it.
Right.
But if I'm thinking about killing you, and that's my intent, and I'm running at you with my knife, and Father Bennett knocks me down, my intent and my actions were the same thing.
Well, that's true, but the fact that you were not able to carry it out is you end up with the lesser sin. That's the argument. So you can ponder on that. I don't want to get too bogged down on this.
Save a person at least temporarily, but don't kill them until they have the opportunity to repent. That's tricky.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the next. I'm glad this is a sparking your thoughts here. Here's another principle that Augustine argues. He basically says that war is a necessary evil in a world which may serve to prevent even greater evils. This is sort of along the same lines that we're just talking about, to save others from evil acts. You having to kill someone to save them from an evil act is a, you know, if you will, a lesser evil. Here, once again, Augustine writes, "But the wise man, they say, will wage just wars. Surely, however, if he remembers that he is a human being, he will be much readier to deplore the fact that he is under the necessity of waging even just wars. For if they were not just, he would not have to wage them. And so there would be no wars at all for a wise man to engage in. For it is the iniquity of the opposing side that imposes upon the wise man the duty of waging wars." So notice, war is always looked upon as a negative to Augustine, but it's a lesser of evils, if you will, sometimes to wage wars, to stop wickedness, to save the people under your care, and so forth, if you're a governing authority. So here we see, of course, that Augustine employs his keen insights into the sinfulness of humanity and makes this very much a part of his argument. I think this is right. And this, of course, kind of tempers what we expect in this life. You know, because we go back to this passage we read this morning, our Old Testament. What about when the Messiah comes, they'll beat their swords into plowshares? Why isn't that happening?
You should prepare.
Well, we should desire this, right? This should be our desire. But Augustine tempers this and says in another place, he says, "But if anyone hopes for so great a good as this, beating swords into plowshares, in the world and on this earth, his wisdom is but folly." So the argument is, those who think that this ought to happen here and now really are not taking into account the presence, the ongoing, continuing presence of sin and evil in the world. And so here's where we get into this idea of already and not yet. Here on the already side, we ought to desire that men would beat their swords into plowshares. That's what we ought to pursue. We ought to always pursue peace. But knowing all along that evil is in the world and that very many times there is the necessity of waging war in order to put down evil and to establish peace. And so that's the argument that he's making. Yes?
So that point seems to invalidate any other advantage. First point,
well, let's think about this. I think if you look, I think just war is the right way. I think it's really in the history of the church is the most thoughtful and consistent way to think about this. If we take the pacifism side, think about those who took up that pacifism primarily in history. It's a withdrawal. Typically, but think about the Amish, the Mennonite. They're withdrawing. We're not going to be involved. We're going to kind of keep ourselves untainted by withdrawing. And so that's kind of the pacifism model. The crusading, the argument is something like an over-realized eschatology. We're going to bring God's kingdom by force. Right? And that, of course, is not right. I think the proper way to think about this is the just war model, where we work and pursue peace. We pursue. We want men to beat their swords into plowshares. However, we recognize that this world has not been totally eradicated of evil yet at this point.
See that point, however, pacifists historically have insisted that pacifism is the legitimate.
Right.
It's a different thing than what I understand Banks to be presenting.
State your question again.
Different thing. That position is different than what Banks is suggesting by mentioning pacifism as one option.
Yeah.
The pacifist, in other words, he says that you could, are not acting Christianly unless you're a pacifist under all conditions.
Well, there certainly are many. I don't know if that's exactly where he ends up. As he presents. Well, he's just historically, right. So he's surveying this and saying these are the three basic models that you have in Christian history. And, you know, what the final analysis is on that, certainly there are many who would make that argument that Christians ought to be just totally pacifists. One of the things that Augustine, I mean, along those lines, has to argue against, kind of fitting with what Bishop Sutton talked about yesterday, is Christians are charged with being irresponsible for not actually fighting, for not protecting the empire. And these are one of the charges laid at the feet of Augustine, and that's part of the reason why he's arguing for this, that there are times where war is just, and therefore Christians can actually engage in war. And he makes the argument that there are Christians in the military, and he actually says that's the best possible idea, is that if all the soldiers were Christians, and all the magistrates and emperors and everybody were Christians, ideally at least, then you would never have anything but just wars. Of course, we know that's not really the reality. That's not the reality, but...
In some measure, you do see the sword being beaten in the plowshare, so to speak, with regard to Christ going forth, conquering him, as John says, forth in Revelation, sword going out this morning, out of his mouth, going forth to conquer. And you see that in the British Isles, for example. In some measure, for a long period of time, you had Christian monarchs, you saw Christian civilization emerge, supplanting the pagan civilization. Not perfectly, but to some degree, you see that progress.
Right.
The real task is sustaining the building.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. Here's where we need to be realistic and have our expectations tempered by the presence and reality of sin in the human heart. And so that's our desire. Our desire is to implement peace and to pursue peace. But we recognize in the midst of this that we've got quite a battle to wage, if you will. Well, let me summarize these principles, I think, as we talked about. In this fallen world, war is an inevitable reality. However, war should be a last resort. The only just war, the only possibility of just war, according to Augustine's thinking, is that it's engaged in by the proper authority. And then is for a just cause, primarily in responding to some, in defense to some aggression coming from outside. And then the ultimate intention of war must be the pursuit of peace. It's always the desire, even in the waging of war, is to bring about peace. Peace for those whom you're protecting, and even peace, if you will, for the aggressors. Well, final questions? Yes?
So how would you counsel in somebody, as a Christian, following Joseph Ramallah, who finds himself in the military, by volunteer or by draft, or depending on how they kind of do so? What responsibility do they have to ensure that a war is just versus just following the orders of the given command?
Once you're in, you're under your commander. I think that's a good question. I think the argument can be made that if you're being commanded to do something that is ungodly, that you fear God rather than man, and so therefore you accept whatever punishment. If you're told to just indiscriminately shoot innocents, of course, that's another thing that Augustine talks about, that it's only the combatants that can be engaged, in war, that the innocents are not to be touched. So if you as a soldier are commanded to go in and shoot everybody in the town indiscriminately, then I think as a Christian, you would say, I'm not doing that. That's not just. And you accept whatever punishment comes your way because you fear God more than man.
Even on a broader level, I can see that and understand that an individual engagement kind of situation like that. But would it be wise for a Christian military person to do the best that they can to make himself aware of the reason for a war? If America goes to war and you're in the American military, should an American military, a Christian in the American military, do everything that they can to make himself aware of the reason for the war? And then are they expected to then judge for themselves or judge a just war?
I think certainly that's why.
That unjust war.
Yeah. And as we know, these things happen. And I guess what I'm saying is as a matter of conscience and as a matter of responsibility before God, if you deem it to be unjust, then you rebel against the earthly authority out of deference to the ultimate authority. That may be easier said than done. I mean, you may face punishment here in this world, but I think that is applicable to the statement we talked about earlier about fearing God more than fearing what man can do to you. Fear, not the one who can take your body only, but one who is body and soul. Are we out of time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, good. Yes. Yes.
Just to follow up on that last thought, not really offering a contrary response to what you're saying, but I do think there's a reason for the requirement of war being waged by the proper authority. Part of that reason is the proper authority is also the one that has
bears the responsibility.
All of the information that is supposed to go into that decision.
Right.
And whether or not we want to make every effort we can make at a lower level, say as an individual member of the military force, we'll never be in a position in that role to deserve to have all that information.
Right, right.
And not to say there isn't some amount of individual judgment there, but I do
right.
think that deference has to be given to the fact that we don't have all the information, and we
That's
have
right.
to trust those in authority over us with it.
Well, and if we have the sense that God is the one who establishes the authorities who are over us, and if we also have the sense that those authorities ultimately are answerable to God for what they command, then they, of course, bear the greater responsibility. There's no question about that. And so you're right in the sense that, we don't have all of the, many times people on the ground don't have all of the knowledge that the other authorities do. Of course, sometimes, yeah, maybe ignorance is bliss on that, you know, because ultimately the authority who orders it, like I say, is responsible for God for that. Yes, Mark.
The way the war is waged has changed. Say with the Napoleonic Wars on, and even in our own case of our own country, from the Civil War on, it becomes much more toward annihilation.
Yeah.
And the weapons that are used, and the church has typically spoken against certain weapons, make it a difficult question too. Can war be waged unjustly when the weapons that are used can be so indiscriminate?
Right, like cannons, for us now bombs, you know, things that are, I think that's a big question that really has to be thought through. Even now, I saw a while back on 60 Minutes, those who were engaged in drone warfare, there's a place out in Arizona or wherever it is, and they're flying drones and bombing people all over the world. They're with this, they've got this conundrum, is this right? Is this right to be doing this? So I think that's a very valid question. There were some influenced by Christians earlier on who knew how to develop some of these weapons and refused to do it because they saw the evil that would come from it. Of course, in Civil War, the War of Northern Aggression, from where I'm from, that they got into that total war mentality. And as soon as they finished with the South, they took it West. So, you know, that I think is highly questionable as to whether or not that's just. Once again, we have to, the church needs to be, in a sense, prophetic to the state in saying, this is not right. Or what you're doing. And so when that time comes, I think we need to be, you know, perhaps raise those questions and not be so quick just to say, oh, well, you know, it's just one of those things. I mean, yeah. Well, and we can't allow our patriotism to trump our responsibility before God. You know, we have to ultimately, we need to be able to look at things that our country has done and be able to say, well, that was just wrong, you know, and we should, that was sinful, we should not have done that. And there, you know, so there are a lot of these issues as you kind of go through history, even just in American history, and you start to think through some of the implications of things that we've done and question whether or not that was right. Of course, hindsight is nice in hindsight to be able to look at these things. Hindsight's 20/20. But nevertheless, I think as Christians, we need to be able to look at these matters and say this is not right. And we do sort of play a prophetic role, if you will, for the state in arguing what is right and just before God, and what isn't. So.